I am Robert Castanello, an assistant professor of history at the University of Central Florida, and you are listening to the Riches Documentary Podcast. This episode was produced by Jeffrey Caviero, and it's the first of a two-part episode that features an interview he conducted with the historian Paul Ortiz at the University of Florida. It covers the research related to his book, Emancipation Betrayed.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey Caviero, and in today's podcast, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Paul Ortiz, who is an associate professor at the University of Florida, as well as their director of the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program. The program's been around since 1967, collecting over 5,000 oral history interviews from Floridians across the state. In this two-part interview, Dr. Ortiz will be talking about his work with the program, as well as the role that specifically African Americans have played in Florida's history. Dr. Ortiz, thank you for offering your time and thoughts to our program. What inspired you to study the African-American struggle in Florida?
In terms of African-American history, in terms of segregation or even civil rights history, there's very little on Florida. Why is that? Well, I didn't know at the time. I'm still trying to figure that out. When African-American communities in the state have had the most remarkable, you know, organized the most remarkable movements anywhere in the country.
In the preface of your book, Emancipation Betrayed, The Hidden History of Black Organizing and White Violence in Florida, From Reconstruction to the Bloody Election of 1920, you mention that previous historiography has depicted the early years of Jim Crow as a lost era of organizing. What led them to this assertion, and are they correct?
We came up against this over and over again, the idea that after the end of Reconstruction, there was this catastrophic decline in black political effectiveness. And that is true in terms of the huge levels of disenfranchisement. I mean, we still haven't come to grips with the fact that the period between 1876 and around 1900 witnessed the worst disenfranchisement of any group of Americans in our nation's history. And the second argument that came out of that was, well, after African Americans were disenfranchised, political possibilities just kind of collapsed, and so communities really turned inward and just tried to sustain and survive as best as they could, which is also true. But the point I was trying to make with the book is that African Americans in Florida still struggled. You know, they still resisted segregation. They didn't simply surrender to inevitability, and in fact, they never accepted the morality or the central premise of Jim Crow segregation, the central premise of which was that they were inferior to white people. That is the central premise of any segregated system of society, whether you're talking about apartheid in South Africa or segregation in the United States, is this idea that to have a system, you have to have the premise on the level of politics and economics and the social life that the people being segregated are inferior, are subhuman. And my argument in Emancipation Betrayed is that African Americans did not accept that premise. They had to deal with state power, which was quite awesome. And when you talk about Central Florida, you're talking about a system of state power which is quite formidable, which is in the courts, the sheriffs, the so-called justice system, which during this period of time was an injustice system, in which sheriffs had a huge incentive to literally manufacture convictions in order to turn prisoners over to northern-owned phosphate and turpentine firms to work, or railroad firms to build railroads, to build roads, to mine phosphate. And so we don't want to de-emphasize the level of oppression that people faced in Jim Crow, but at the same time I found through research that African Americans never surrendered. They never accepted what was supposed to be an inevitable system. It was supposed to be a system that they kind of internalized. What I found was that African Americans fought back on a number of different fronts. One of the most important areas was they tried to regain access to the ballot. There are many other important things that they tried to gain access to, but at a certain point it was decided that the ballot and politics were a key part of the Jim Crow system, and unless you could break through the barrier of disenfranchisement, you couldn't address the larger or the other problems of Jim Crow.
In your study, you describe how African Americans actively resisted white supremacy through organizing, but also through armed self-help or armed self-reliance. What did you mean by that?
Well, often it's hard to disentangle the different forms of organizing. I mean, to take one example, labor organizing. I mean, this is one area where African Americans, I mean, a real linchpin of the system of Jim Crow is in its ability. You know, once you lose your political rights, you lose your economic rights in a system such as ours. In other words, if you don't have the right to political representation, then economically I can pay you anything I want to, because you're not covered under any, you know, any labor laws. You don't have the right to petition. And so the labor organizing was a key part of what African Americans were trying to do. And sometimes that connected very intimately to, I think you mentioned the term armed self-help. Florida had the highest per capita lynching rate of any state in the country between the end of Reconstruction to the Great Depression. And when I first came across that statistic, I was rather shocked, because I always assumed, well, Mississippi must have been worse, Alabama must have been worse. But what I found in Florida is that time and time again, incidents of racial violence would start in the workplace. And so sometimes they would begin with a strike. A group of black workers go out and strike, try to get higher wages. Or employers try to hammer wages down, and African Americans are caught in that. And so it's no mistake that if you look, at least the incidents that I looked at in the book, very often, the incidents of anti-black violence start quite often in the workplace, because it's the place where economic rewards are being given out. And what I call armed self-help is something that if you live in a state where your life is considered to be very cheap, and that was the situation for black people in Florida, at times they were able to organize. Again, often in their workplaces, armed self-help groups, that is, they were able to band together and stop lynchings from occurring by taking up arms in a defensive way. And in fact, many of your listeners will be familiar with Ida B. Wells, and Wells is one of the great figures in American history. She was really, in many ways, the most prominent anti-lynching activist of the late 19th, early 20th century. Wells wrote about Florida, and what she said was that African Americans in Florida had come up with one solution to the lynching problem, which was that they were learning to take up arms against the lynchers, or the would-be lynchers. And it didn't always work. Wasn't always effective. And when you took up arms against the system, you had to also consider the fact that you could face worse repercussions for doing that, you know. And one example in the Central Florida dimension is that phosphate workers were often migrant workers, and many African Americans were migrant workers, you know, having to travel up and down the state just to make ends meet in these very low-wage jobs. The phosphate industry was enormously profitable. Phosphate and turpentine were commodities traded on the New York Stock Exchange. But because they were volatile commodities, investors insisted that firms keep their labor costs low in order to gain the maximum profit out of these commodities. This was true in phosphates. It was true in turpentine and resins. And, you know, people still, I mean, turpentine is still an important thing, but it was even more important back in this earlier period, because when in the era of wooden ships, turpentine was a huge deal. Resins were a huge deal coming out of Florida, you know, forests. Well, in the phosphate industry, in towns like Bartow, Lakeland, Polk County, and other areas, if you look at race relations in those towns, they were often quite violent, quite chaotic. And again, we cannot disentangle the economic dimension from the racial dimension, because the firms who worked in those parts of the state were trying to hammer down wages, keep them as low as possible. The workers are trying to make a living wage. And so right there you have a conflict. And my belief out of the research is that often that economic conflicts were at the heart of a lot, not all, but a lot of the racial conflicts. And so I found that phosphate workers in Central Florida sometimes took up arms to defend their comrades from being lynched. And it wasn't surprising on one level. On another level, initially people were kind of stunned when I brought my dissertation back and started giving people the results and finding these articles in newspapers, the governor's papers, you know, other private collections, and saying, well, yes, actually sometimes people took up arms to stop lynching from occurring. And I think it was challenging for some people to read, because the civil rights era literature says that nonviolence is the real key philosophy. And what I found in the Jim Crow period was that people felt that they couldn't afford sometimes to be pacifist. You know, it wasn't like they were going out and attacking lynchers. They were. Ida B. Wells wrote about this in 1892. She said, you know, the people of Florida, black people, have come up with one solution to this larger problem. She said, we're being lynched on a weekly and even daily basis, and we can use all the moral persuasion we want, and moral persuasion is very important. However, sometimes moral persuasion just doesn't get the job done.
Could you tell us a little about the Florida voter registration movement of 1919 to 1920, and what sort of role African Americans in Central Florida may have played in that?
This was the voter registration movement in the wake of World War I was one of the most significant political movements in American history. African Americans in Central Florida, South Florida, North Florida, you know, the Panhandle, organized a statewide voter registration movement to regain the right to vote and to create a new kind of political party. They organized through the Republican Party, but in reality, I argue in the book that the Republican Party became kind of an independent party. That is, the Republican Party in 1920 was no longer the party of Lincoln. It was the party of Warren G. Harding. And it was a party which had become hollowed out, taken over by corporate interests, and African Americans were the key critics of that party. And they said that the Republican Party used to be the party of human rights. Now it's a party of John D. Rockefeller. What happened? And so in Florida, there's this huge effort to reform or even revolutionize the Republican Party, regain the right to vote. And it's a period of tremendous excitement and energy, in part because the nation has just fought in its first World War. And tens of thousands of African Americans are returning from France to Florida, to Georgia, to Mississippi, and other places, and saying, you sent us over there to fight for democracy. So when we come back home, we expect democracy here. The state of Florida, of course, says, well, no, that's not what we meant. We wanted you to fight for democracy over there, but not here. And so what African Americans did was, they used their service in the war, which was formidable and very wide-ranging. We don't think about it now, but during actually both world wars, the federal government did not have enough money to even purchase a uniform for its military officers. And that money had to be either raised by private individuals or communities. And so that's why you had Liberty loans or thrift savings stamps. In Florida, African Americans participated in all of those things, and they organized their own independent fundraising drives to help the troops fight in Europe. And they would raise money to buy food, blankets, medical supplies for the troops. But again, as they were doing these things, they tried to remind the larger society, we're participating on a civic basis in American, in this American war for democracy. So when the war is over, we're going to come back and we're going to ask for democracy here. And they made that very clear. I mean, it's, you see it over and over again in black newspapers and in black media, in the statements that black political leaders or ordinary people on the street were making, or you know, a combat infantryman who comes back from France and says, you know, we had some of the most highly decorated units in the entire Allied army, and now we're not going to come back and accept second-class treatment.
I'd like to thank Dr. Ortiz for joining our discussion. If you'd like to learn more about the African-American struggle in Florida, look for Dr. Ortiz's book, Emancipation Betrayed, The Hidden History of Black Organizing and White Violence in Florida, From Reconstruction to the Bloody Election of 1920. I'm Jeffrey Crivero. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for listening to The Riches Podcast. And don't forget to join us in March of 2013 when we launch our new podcast series.